It is January 2026, and if you're a chief data officer or maybe a security architect in the healthcare space right now, you are? Well, you're standing at a very strange intersection.
It's more like a collision, a
Yeah.
collision of two massive tectonic forces that frankly shouldn't be able to coexist.
That's a great way to put it, a paradox. On one hand, you've got this federal mandate train. It's been chugging along since the early 2020s. We're talking about CMS interoperability.
Right.
And the rule is simple, right? Share the data, tear down the silos, give patients, give providers access to everything seamlessly, probably via APIs. That's the law of the land.
The whole philosophy is liquidity. Your data needs to flow to be useful. It can't be locked away in a basement server anymore.
But then crashing right into that from the complete other direction is the reality of AI integration here in 2026. And we aren't just talking about, some predictive analytics in the background.
No, not at all. We're talking about autonomous clinical agents, really heavy LLM integration into workflows. These are systems that don't just view data.
They ingest it, they train on it, they
Yep.
effectively eat it.
And that's the friction point. That is the fundamental conflict. CMS is saying open the doors, but Security Architecture 101 says, wait a minute, if you open the doors to an AI that learns from the data, you lose control of that data forever.
Forever. You can't exactly hit undo on the neural weights of a large language model once it's seen a patient record.
You can't. It's absorbed.
Which brings us to the document we are tearing apart today. This is a technical evaluation of the PQC Plus platform, and it focuses specifically on how it navigates this exact minefield.
Right, it's a 20-page deep dive into two specific modules, Smart Compliance and Smart InfoSecure.
And for all the architects listening right now, you should know this isn't some marketing brochure, it's a technical validation document.
It's trying to answer a very pointed question. How do you satisfy the CMS mandate for openness while at the same time protecting data from AI overreach and this emerging quantum threat?
The quantum threat. That usually feels like something we can push off to the 2030 problem pile. It's a future problem.
It always feels like a future problem.
But this document argues pretty forcefully that it's a 2026 problem. And the reason is this vector called harvest now, decrypt later.
We'll get into that.
We are definitely going to get into the math of that later on, specifically how they're using things like lattice-based cryptography. But I actually want to start with the governance piece.
Good place to start.
Yeah.
The governance piece is the foundation. If you don't solve the policy logic first, the fanciest encryption in the world doesn't matter.
So the document centers on a concept that I think it changes the paradigm entirely. It talks about moving from access control to something called embedded policy.
That's the shift. It's a move from, let's say, perimeter defense to object-level defense.
What does that mean in practice?
Well, think about how we do things now. We build walls, we build moats. We say, if you have the password, if you have the key, you get past the gate, and then you have the data.
And the data itself is just passive.
Exactly. It's just sitting there waiting to be read by whoever got through the door.
Embedded policy implies something different. It implies the data is active.
The data carries its own rules with it. It's not just a file anymore. It's a file that's been mathematically wrapped in a logic that says, I will only reveal myself if these very specific conditions, like time, role, context, are met.
So it's enforcing the rules at the atomic level of the data itself, not just at the network edge.
Precisely. And that distinction is just. It's so critical because, as you mentioned, the CMS interoperability framework, it was designed for a world that looked very, very different.
Let's actually walk through that old world framework. CMS built this whole thing on five pillars. Pillar was patient access, apps, transparency. Pillar two, provider access. Pillar for third was data availability.
That's your US CDI standards, FHIRR4, all that.
Right. Then network connectivity, and finally, pillar V, identity, security, and trust, things like IL2 credentials.
And on their own, these pillars are solid. I mean, they're really good for a human-centric workflow.
Human-centric. Explain that.
Okay, take pillar two, provider access. The whole intent there is that if I'm an ER doctor and you come in unconscious, I can pull your records from your primary care physician in another state.
A point-to-point transfer. A human requests, a human views, a human treats.
Simple.
Very simple. But now, let's introduce an AI agent into that ER. The agent pulls the exact same record. But it's not just to treat you, it's potentially to update its own internal model of, say, 45-year-old cardiac symptoms.
And the old rules just don't account for that distinction.
They can't. The TPO model treatment, payment, operations from HIPAA allows for what it calls healthcare operations.
Okay.
In the past, operations meant things like quality improvement studies or billing audits. But the question for 2026 is, does training a proprietary third-party commercial model count as a healthcare operation?
And the CMS framework doesn't explicitly say no. It's a gray area, a huge one. So what you have is this situation where the infrastructure, the APIs, the FHIR standards, is essentially a high-speed highway designed for cars, you know, for humans.
But now we have freight trains, these AIs, trying to use the same road.
And that mismatch, that fundamental conflict in design, creates what this evaluation calls the five critical AI governance gaps.
And these aren't just like little compliance risks you can patch over. The document frames them as structural failures in how we even think about data rights.
They really are.
Let's drill into these gaps, because I have a feeling a lot of our listeners are trying to patch these manually right now with duct tape and wishful thinking.
I'm sure they are.
Gap one is AI-specific consent. The document has a great term for this. It calls it the policy fiction.
The fiction is that consent for treatment is the same thing as consent for computation.
Right.
When a patient signs that form on a clipboard, they are agreeing to be healed. They are agreeing to let you use their data to make them better. They are not in any way agreeing to become a training node for a commercially owned algorithm that might be sold to another hospital system.
But an institution might argue that if the data is de-identified, or if it falls under that vague TPO operations clause, they have the right.
They might claim it legally, sure, but ethically, and I would argue technically, it's a complete disaster waiting to happen.
How so?
Because if you can't distinguish at the actual database query level between fetch this record for Dr. Smith's surgery prep and fetch this record for the Q3 model fine-tuning batch, then you have lost the ability to honor the patient's actual intent.
You need a system that sees the purpose of the query.
The purpose, the intent, not just the credentials of the user making the query.
Which flows directly into the second gap, continuous model monitoring. This gets at something called model drift. We know these models aren't static, right?
Not at all. They drift, sometimes significantly. You train a model on, say, 2024 data. By 2026, the demographics of your actual patient population might have shifted completely.
Maybe you have a larger immigrant population, or, I don't know, a new factory opened up and it's driving asthma rates through the roof.
Exactly. If the model is still locked into its 2024 assumptions, it starts making errors. It becomes less effective or worse, biased.
And the gap here, as the document points out, is that our standard audit logs, the stuff we all use for HIPAA compliance, they're binary.
Super binary. They just say, Dr. Smith accessed the file at 3.05 p.m.
They don't track. The model accessed the file and as a result weighed factor X more heavily than factor Y in its subsequent 50 diagnoses.
We completely lack the why. We have the who and the when, but yeah. AI forces us to audit the inference, the actual logic. And the paper argues that without continuous monitoring of the model's performance against current real-world data, you are just flying blind.
Which connects to the third gap, data rights and transparency. I really like the AI nutrition label concept here. It feels like a bit of a buzzword, but in this context, it seems absolutely necessary.
It's crucial. I'd say it's crucial for clinical trust. If I'm a clinician on the floor and an AI suggests a pretty aggressive treatment plan, I need to know the provenance of that insight.
You need to know where it came from.
I need to know, was this model trained on a population that actually resembles my patient? If I'm treating, say, a geriatric patient in rural Idaho, and I find out the model was trained exclusively on urban data from Boston.
That's a huge bias risk. The recommendation might be completely wrong for your patient.
It could be. And right now, the interoperability standards, they don't require that metadata to travel with the insight.
No, they just deliver the output, the recommendation.
Mm-hmm. The nutrition label would force the system to declare its ingredients, basically, the training data demographics, right alongside the diagnosis it's suggesting.
Okay, so that's three gaps. Gap four is a bit different. It's about workflow fragmentation. They call it the problem of plenty.
Yes, and this is less about the deep ethics and more about pure operational friction.
The swivel chair problem.
The swivel chair problem, but on steroids. Think about it. You have an AI scribe over here. You have a diagnostic support tool from another vendor, a billing coder bot from a third.
And they don't talk to each other.
If they're all separate size solutions, you just end up creating brand new data silos. The entire CMS goal is interoperability, but the wild proliferation of niche AI tools often leads to the exact opposite. More fragmentation.
So the data gets stuck. It gets trapped in the proprietary formats of all these different AI vendors instead of flowing back into the structured EHR where it belongs.
Right. It breaks the loop.
And And finally, we get to gap five. And this is the one that, well, it arguably renders the previous four completely irrelevant if we don't fix it. Post-quantum security.
The timeline mismatch.
This is the existential risk, isn't it?
It absolutely is, because healthcare data is what we call long-tail data. Think about it. You can cancel a stolen credit card. You can change a password.
You cannot change your genome.
You cannot change your psychiatric history. You cannot change a diagnosis of a chronic condition. That data needs to be secure for 30, 40, maybe 50 years, legally and ethically.
But the encryption that's protecting it today, your standard RSA, your ECC, has a shelf life, and that shelf life is rapidly expiring.
We are looking at a horizon of, what, maybe 5 to 10 years before a cryptographically relevant quantum computer, a CRQC, becomes a viable tool for adversaries.
So if you are protecting 30-year data with what is effectively 10-year encryption, you have a 20-year exposure window. It's just simple math.
And that's the vulnerability.
That brings us right back to the harvest now, decrypt later strategy. We're going to unpack that in a lot more detail when we get to the cryptoception of this. But first, let's look at how PQC Plus proposes to plug these governance gaps we just walked through. This is all in the smart compliance module.
Okay. So the architecture here is really interesting because it doesn't just sit on the side. It inserts itself directly into the data flow. It uses something they call the Model Context Protocol, or MCP.
Let's get technical on MCP. This isn't just some passive log file that you check once a month, right? This is an active gateway.
It's an active interceptor. It sits logically between the requester, whether that's a human clinician or an AI agent, and the data repository itself. And it operates in milliseconds.
So a query comes in.
A query comes in, and the MCP analyzes the context of that query before it ever allows the data to be retrieved.
It's evaluating the intent of the query, not just the who.
Correct. It's looking at the user's attributes, the session context, and crucially, a specific purpose flag in the request. And all of that allows for this incredibly granular consent and dynamic masking.
Okay, give us a concrete scenario. How did that actually play out in a hospital?
All right, let's take a patient. We'll call her Jane. Jane has a surgery scheduled. She has, of course, consented to her data being used for her surgical treatment, but on the consent form, she specifically opted out of third-party research sharing.
Okay, a common choice.
A very common choice. So, scenario A. Her surgeon's AI assistant queries her record to help prep for the OR. The MCP sees the query. It reads, role, surgeon, context, clinical care, time now.
And it lets it through.
It releases the full fidelity record, images, lab notes, everything the clinical team needs. Now, scenario B, 5 minutes later, a university research bot, which is authorized to be on the network, queries the same database for a big population health study. It hits Jane's record.
But this time the context is different.
Completely different. The MCP sees role, researcher, context, anonymous study. It immediately checks Jane's specific consent policy.
And the policy says no research.
Now, here's the clever part. Instead of just returning a hard access denied, which might break the researcher's data set, the system applies dynamic masking on the fly.
What does that mean?
It means, in that millisecond, it strips out her name, her address, her date of birth, any PII. But it leaves the structured clinical values, like her blood pressure or the diagnosis codes.
Ah, so it happens in real time.
In real time. The research bot gets the anonymized data it needs to calculate trends, but Jane's specific privacy instruction is mathematically enforced.
So that solves the policy fiction we talked about. You can support both use cases without ever violating the specific consent of the patient.
And it goes further. It also handles what they call jurisdictional awareness, which, I mean, it's becoming a complete nightmare for compliance officers.
Because we have this patchwork of laws.
An insane patchwork. You have IPA, which is the federal baseline. Then you have CCPA in California. Then you have the whole post-Dobbs landscape for reproductive health data, which varies wildly from state to state.
And data moves across state lines constantly. A patient from Texas might get treated in a hospital in New York.
Exactly. So how do you manage that? The Smart Compliance Engine uses sensitive tagging. It's trained to automatically identify specific data classes, reproductive health, substance use disorder, which falls under 42 CFR Part 2 HIV status.
The really sensitive stuff.
Most sensitive stuff. So if a query tries to move data tagged as reproductive health from a protected jurisdiction, say California, to a restricted one, the MCP can flag it or block it entirely based on the geolocation of the requester.
That seems like the only scalable way to manage it. You can't expect a database administrator to be sitting there manually configuring firewall rules for every new state bill that passes.
You absolutely can't. It has to be automated. It has to be at the attribute level of the data itself.
Okay. And what underpins all of this? How do you prove it's working?
Well, that's the last piece of the governance engine, the audit engine.
Mm.
The document makes a point to highlight that this meets IAL2, AAL2 requirements. Those are the NIST standards for identity assurance.
Right.
But the key feature, I think, is that the audit logs themselves are cryptographically signed, and they are append only.
Meaning, once an AI accesses a record, that event is etched in stone. You can't change it. You can't delete it.
It creates an immutable chain of evidence. So if, down the line, an AI model hallucinates or provides a clearly biased recommendation that was based on a specific patient's record, you can trace the exact millisecond it ingested that data. You can prove the chain of custody for every piece of information that fed the model.
Okay, so that's the governance layer. It's designed to keep the AI honest and the data compliant with the patient's wishes and the law.
Mm.
But now we have to talk about the adversary who doesn't care one bit about your compliance engine. Now we have to talk about the quantum threat.
This is where we shift from policy and rules to pure hard math.
Harvest now, decrypt later, HNDL. We touched on it earlier, but I want to really understand the scope of this. This isn't just some theoretical academic risk.
No, this is a current operational reality. Make no mistake. Nation-state actors, sophisticated criminal organizations, they are siphoning and harvesting encrypted internet traffic today. Right now, they are capturing the TLS handshake, they are capturing the encrypted ciphertext, and they were storing it in massive data centers, petabytes of it.
They can't read it yet.
Not yet.
Not yet.
They can't read it yet. They're waiting for the key. In this case, the key isn't a password they can steal. It's a machine. A machine that hasn't been perfected yet. A quantum computer capable of running Shor's algorithm.
Shor's algorithm. That's the famous one. That's the one that breaks RSA, correct?
It's the killer app for quantum computers, so to speak. Our current public key encryption, RSA, Diffie-Hellman, elliptic curve, it all relies on the mathematical difficulty of certain problems.
Like factoring huge numbers.
Exactly. Factoring large integers or solving discrete logarithm problems. Our classical computers, even the biggest supercomputers on Earth, are terrible at this. It would take them millions of years to factor a standard 2048-bit RSA key.
But a quantum computer, it doesn't play by the same rules.
It works on different physics entirely. It uses quantum superposition and entanglement. And Shor's algorithm very cleverly turns that hard factoring problem into something called a period finding problem, which a quantum computer can solve exponentially faster.
So it's not just faster, it's a different approach.
It's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. A classical computer checks one piece of hay at a time. A quantum computer can, in a sense, look at all the hay at once. It just cuts through RSA encryption like a hot knife through butter.
So let's play this out. If I'm an attacker, I steal the encrypted medical database of a major hospital today in 2026. I hold on to it for 10 years.
You just store it. It costs you almost nothing.
Then in 2036, I rent some time on a quantum cloud service. I run Shor's algorithm against that stolen data. And suddenly, I have the unencrypted genetic history of a million people.
And that data is valuable forever. You can use it for blackmail, for targeted bioweapon research, for creating synthetic identities that could span generations. That is the HNDL threat. It's a ticking time bomb.
So how does Smart Info Secure, the other module in this platform, stop this? The evaluation points directly to the new NIST standards, FIPS 203, 204, and 205.
Right, so these are the post-quantum cryptography, or PQC, standards that NIST has been working on for years and is now finalized. And Smart Info Secure just implements them. That's the first line of defense.
Okay, let's break them down.
First, you have FIPS 203. The algorithm is called MLChem, which stands for Module Lattice-Based Key Encapsulation Mechanism. This is what replaces your classic RSA or Diffie-Hellman key exchange, is how you establish the secure tunnel in the first place.
And the key words there are lattice-based cryptography. We need to get into the weeds here. Why is a lattice harder for a quantum computer to break than a large integer?
A great question. Let's try to visualize it. In RSA, you're basically hiding two prime numbers inside one very large number. It's a clean, elegant math problem.
Okay.
In lattice cryptography, specifically a variant called learning with errors, or LWE, imagine a perfectly regular city grid. But instead of being flat in 2D, it's in 500 or even 1,000 dimensions.
Hard to picture, but okay.
It is. Now, I pick a point on one of those intersections, but I don't give you the exact coordinates. Instead, I give you a location that's close to the intersection. but I've added a tiny bit of random mathematical noise or jitter to the location.
So the coordinates are fuzzy.
They are intentionally fuzzy. And your job is to find the actual intersection I started from. To find that closest vector, you have to solve this massive, messy optimization problem across hundreds of dimensions, all while trying to filter out the random noise I added.
And a quantum computer isn't good at that.
The crucial part is that this problem structure doesn't have the same properties that Shor's algorithm exploits. Quantum superposition doesn't really help you find that needle in that 500-dimensional noisy haystack significantly faster than a classical computer could.
So it's a structural defense. It's not just a harder problem. It's a different kind of problem that's resistant to known quantum attacks.
Exactly. That's the core innovation.
Yeah.
So that's FIPS S203 for the key exchange. Then the platform layers in Fixed S204, which is MLDSA, for digital signatures.
Yeah.
That's how you prove your identity.
And then there's a third one, FIPS S205, SLHDSA. Why do we need that one if the other two are lattice-based?
It's basically an insurance policy, a cryptographic diversification. Both FIPS 203 and 204 are based on the hardness of lattice problems.
So you have all your eggs in the lattice basket.
Right. And it's a really big if, but if some brilliant mathematician in 10 years discovers a novel way to attack lattice problems, you don't want your entire security posture to collapse.
So FIPS 205 uses different math.
Completely different math. It's a hash-based signature scheme called SVLE NCS plus 6 text. Hash functions are a much older, more studied area of cryptography. So if lattices were ever to fail, you'd still have a secure way to do signatures. It provides what's called cryptographic diversity.
Smart. It's a belt and suspenders approach. But here is the part of the document that I found the most, well, the most revolutionary. We have this new math with lattices, but PQC plus combines this with something called attribute-based encryption, or ABE.
Yes.
And they use it to do something called embedded policy encryption.
This is the real differentiator. This is the second line of defense that stops HNDL, even if, theoretically, the underlying crypto eventually fails someday far in the future.
Okay, so walk me through this. Traditional encryption is what? It's all or nothing, right?
All or nothing. I encrypt a file, I give you the key, use the key, you unlock the file. The file itself is dumb. It has no idea who you are or why you're opening it.
Right. If you have the key, you're in.
Attribute-based encryption completely changes that relationship. In ABE, the ciphertext, the scrambled data itself, is generated with a logical policy embedded directly into its mathematical structure.
So the math itself contains a rule.
Exactly. The formula looks something like this. Message plus policy, e.g. role doctor and depth cardiology. Ciphertext. Now, to decrypt that ciphertext, your private key isn't just a random string of bits. Your private key must mathematically possess the attributes doctor and cardiology.
So let me get this straight. If I am an attacker and I steal the encrypted file, and I even manage to steal a private key, but that key only has the attribute role admin, the math just fails.
It's not even that the software denies you access. The mathematics of the decryption function fail to resolve. You physically cannot derive the original plaintext because the attributes in your key do not satisfy the logical policy that is embedded in the ciphertext. There is no admin override.
That is profound. It's a fundamental shift in where the security lives. But how does this stop the harvest now, decrypt later attack? If the attacker breaks the underlying lattice math in 10 years, can't they just bypass the attributes?
Ah, this is the final elegant checkmate. This involves using time-bound policies as one of the attributes.
Time itself is an attribute.
Yes. So let's say a piece of patient data is encrypted today with the embedded policy, role doctor, and death. Time window, January 2026. Nope. The attacker steals that encrypted data blob in 2026. They store it. They wait. In 2036, they finally have their quantum computer. They've broken the lattice problem. They try to brute force the decryption.
But it's 2036.
The decryption function, the math, requires a valid cryptographically signed timestamp for January 2026 to complete the equation. The attacker cannot generate that trusted timestamp because the trusted time authority has long since moved on. The time attribute in the policy fails.
So even if they break the outer shell?
Even if they crack the underlying lattice-based encryption, the policy logic that's baked into the data itself remains unsatisfied. The data is essentially dead. It has expired because its validity window has mathematically closed.
Wow. That turns data from being a static asset that you have to protect forever into a perishable good.
It creates ephemeral data. It ensures that stolen data has a strict, cryptographically enforced expiration date. It's not just a setting in a server config file. It's physics. It completely kills the return on investment for the attacker. Why would you spend millions to steal and store terabytes of data today if it will all be mathematically unreadable by the time you have the tools to crack it?
It effectively neutralizes the entire incentive structure of the HNDL attack model.
It does. It's a true defense-in-depth strategy. You have stronger walls, which are the lattices, plus you have smarter data, which is the embedded policy.
Now, all of this sounds incredible on paper, but in healthcare, you know as well as I do, we deal with legacy systems, we have mainframes still running in hospital basements. Can you actually deploy something this advanced? The document makes a big deal about having an FDA authority to operate, an ATO.
And they should make a big deal of it. An FDA ATO is a very high bar. It means this isn't just some beta code running on a developer's laptop. The FDA has validated the entire cybersecurity architecture, likely as part of a formal medical device or a platform assessment.
So it's been through federal-level scrutiny.
Intense scrutiny. It puts it in a completely different league than standard commercial software that might just have, say, a HITRUST certification. It implies a deep look at the supply chain, the entropy sources for generating the keys, and a rigorous validation of how the NIST standards were actually implemented in code.
And what about deployment? Is this a cloud-only solution? Because that's a non-starter for a lot of organizations.
No, and it can't be. That would be a major limitation. The evaluation specifies hybrid, cloud-native, which is FedRAMP authorized, and fully air-gapped options.
That air-gapped option sounds important.
It's crucial for high-value genomic research or for military-adjacent healthcare systems like the VA. You can run the key generation and the entire policy engine in a completely isolated environment, physically disconnected from any network. This prevents any possibility of remote exfiltration of the root keys or the policy engine itself.
So if we were to summarize the findings of this entire 20-page technical evaluation, PQC Plus seems to effectively check all the boxes for the CMS interoperability mandates. Mm-hmm. While wrapping the whole thing in this quantum-resistant, deeply policy-aware security shell.
I'd say it exceeds the mandates. CMS asks for interoperability. This provides secure interoperability. It systematically closes those five AI governance gaps we discussed: consent, drift, transparency, workflow, and of course, quantum risk.
Hmm.
And it does it not by adding more bureaucracy or more checklists for people to follow,
but by upgrading the physics.
By upgrading the physics of the security layer itself.
It really feels like the transition the document talks about. Moving from policy as a configuration where some admin goes and ticks a box in the settings panel to policy as cryptography.
That is the perfect takeaway. We're entering an era where we can't trust the perimeter anymore. We can't trust the network. We can't even trust all the users. We can only trust the math. And by embedding the rules into the math, you ensure that the data protects itself, regardless of where it travels or who manages to get their hands on it.
And I think for the security architects and the CDOs listening, the message from this is crystal clear. The quantum era isn't some far-off sci-fi concept. It's being prepared for right now by your adversaries. The time to transition your key infrastructure is before the harvest begins, not after the decryption starts breaking news headlines.
Absolutely. The cost of migrating your crypto infrastructure today is, well, it's high. It's not trivial. But the cost of remediation in 2030 or 2035 is infinite. You cannot remediate a breach of unchangeable biometric or genetic data. It's gone forever.
A sobering but absolutely necessary perspective. We've gone pretty deep here on the CMS pillars, the risks of AI data ingestion, lattice-based crypto, and this fascinating idea of attribute-based encryption. Hopefully, for everyone listening, this gives you the ammo you need for that next budget meeting with the board.
Just tell them. We need new math.
Simple as that. Thank you so much for guiding us through the density of this evaluation. It was incredibly insightful.
It's always a pleasure to unpack the future.
And to our listeners, a final provocative thought to leave you with. If your most sensitive healthcare data is encrypted today with a key that you know will be broken in 10 years, is that data really private? Or is it just temporarily secret? The transition to post-quantum cryptography isn't just an upgrade. It's a necessity for permanence. Stay encrypted, stay compliant, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.